Welcome to the Basic Christianity Podcast, a college lecture series by ancient language and biblical scholar, Dr. Stanley D. Walters, presented by his student, Dr. Stanley D. Williams. The 33 lectures are found in Dr. Walters' fully illustrated book, Basic Christianity, Facts, Evidences, Reasons, available at ninevascrossing.com. Lecture 8. Outside Independent Evidences, Part 1.
Now, class, today we're going to look into the fascinating aspects of evidences that come to us from outside the immediate Christian circles that developed soon after Christ's resurrection. We will deal with these in the next couple of lectures. As far as for today, there are three topics I want to cover. First, Paul, then Luke, and finally, a few archaeological discoveries that pertain to the New Testament. Now, some of you will be astute enough to object to including Paul and Luke in a category of outside independent evidence. What I mean by labeling them as such will become clear. But do consider that neither Paul nor Luke were numbered among Jesus' followers during Jesus' ministry, passion, resurrection, or even post-resurrection. Paul and Luke do not come onto the scene as Christians, at least until after the resurrection. And in terms of their independence, well, there may not be two more independent characters in the New Testament story. And I include in that the Roman leaders, none of whom exercised a great deal of independent or entrepreneurial spirit, whereas both Paul and Luke were their own men in nearly every way. And as we move through this material, I hope that will become obvious, if it is not on its face.
Paul.
In the first place, let's examine a few very interesting aspects about someone who, although he did not meet Jesus in the flesh, nonetheless defines the character of the New Testament, short of Jesus himself. And this is none other than the missionary disciple, Paul. Now, there are several things that make Paul worthy of inquiry. For one thing, Paul's 13 letters, which we find in the New Testament, are perhaps the earliest of any writings in the New Testament. Scholars estimate they have all been written from about 48 to 60 AD, which is certainly earlier than the Gospels, which were written between 60 and 90 AD. Of the 13 Pauline epistles, 4, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, and Philemon, were written during his first Roman imprisonment, and 2 Timothy was written during his second imprisonment, just before his martyrdom under orders from Roman Emperor Nero. Paul is also unusual because, though he was a Jew, he was also a Roman citizen. His Jewish name was Saul. He was born and raised in the bustling city of Tarsus in Asia Minor, a place rich in Greek culture, which shows up in his writing and preaching. He was educated by a well-known rabbi, Gamaliel, who was a Pharisee. So that makes Paul a Pharisee, and he may have even been a member of the Sanhedrin at one point, which was like the Supreme Court of the land. Now, just as a side note, because Paul was a Pharisee, he may have found it easier to accept Christ's resurrection from the dead and the Christian doctrine of the resurrection of all believers. If he had been a Sadducee, he might have been harder to convince. Do you wonder if one of the reasons God chose Paul was because he was a Pharisee and not a Sadducee? Sometimes it's fun to think about things like that. How do you remember the difference between Pharisee and Sadducees? The Sadducees were sad, you see, that there was no bodily resurrection from the dead, and that the law alone couldn't save you.
Paul's conversion.
At any rate, in Acts 8, Luke tells us, Saul was trying to destroy the church, entering house after house and dragging out men and women. He handed them over for imprisonment. You see, Saul, being a Pharisee, was particularly jealous of following the law, the Jewish law. And this put him at odds with the Christians, who, as Saul saw it, were trying to dismantle the Mosaic law that was deeply entrenched in Jewish religion and tradition. The zealousness on Saul's part led to his overseeing the stoning of Stephen, whom he recognizes as a threat to the entire Jewish culture. In his later letters to the Galatians, Paul writes,
For you have heard of my former life in Judaism, how I persecuted the church of God violently and tried to destroy it.
Not long after Stephen's death, Saul receives permission from the Sanhedrin to expand his persecution of Christians outside his normal borders and travel to Damascus. And on the road to Damascus, in a spectacular vision, he meets Jesus, and everything changed. The vision is so dazzling, Paul goes blind. And although Paul's companions don't see the vision, they do hear the voice.
Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?
And so, as Luke recounts in Acts 9, Saul is led, now blinded, to the home in Damascus of a man named Judas, where Saul does not eat or drink for 3 days. Thereupon, Ananias, who has been directed to Judas's house by a vision from God, lays hands on Saul and prays for him. Scales fall from Saul's eyes, and he can see again. Ananias baptizes Saul, and then, amazingly, Paul immediately moves in with some of Jesus' followers in Damascus, and as Luke tells us, at once proclaims Jesus in the synagogues as the Son of God. Paul was clearly a quick study. Of course, this confounded everyone, for Saul was well known as a persecutor of Christians. But then Luke tells us,
After a long time had passed, the local Jews plotted to kill Saul and were watching for him to escape at night by one of the city gates. But Saul's friends took him to a hole in the city wall and let him down in a basket.
Saul scampers off to Jerusalem, tries to join the disciples, but of course everyone is afraid of this man. In their mind, he's their arch enemy. But Saul is able to finally convince them that he's been preaching about Jesus in the synagogue at Damascus. And finally, Barnabas takes Saul, no doubt secretly, to the apostles for an interrogation. At least that is what I expect happened. So between the disciples in Damascus and apostles in Jerusalem, and his own knowledge of the Torah and chasing Christians around the countryside, Saul is well versed in Christian thinking. And within a few days or weeks, the Jews are hot on Paul's trail again, and the apostles send him secretly away to his hometown in Tarsus for safety, and no doubt to think about his future. Years later, Paul is sent by the church at Antioch and Jerusalem on 3 missionary journeys throughout the nearby regions, and finally on a 4th and final trip to Rome, where he is imprisoned and dies.
Paul as evidence of Christianity's truth.
Now consider that the conversion of Saul to Christianity offers us as evidence that Christianity and the record of the New Testament is true. Saul is introduced in the New Testament as the arch enemy of Christians. He's literally overseeing their execution. And suddenly, he is one of them, becomes a major evangelist for the faith, and like Stephen, Paul's life is now threatened. This is astonishing. This is not a switch he made out of self-serving aggrandizement, power, riches, or prestige. In fact, he no doubt received ridicule and hard questions from his fellow Pharisees and the Sanhedrin. He must have been the laughing stock for a while. And later, on account of his preaching, which must have been very convincing, he is chased down and stoned. He hides out. He preserves through 3 or 4 shipwrecks, survives all of them, goes without food, and faces many other hardships. While we can say his life was an adventure, we also have to say his life was never safe. Why would anyone do something out of fancy to be put through all of that for a lie, or for something that he knew was fake or a fantasy? There is no other reason than Christianity appeared and appealed to Paul as true, and he believed the evidence and the testimony of others, that he was willing to die for that truth. Bruce says,
"The conversion of Paul has for long been regarded as weighty evidence of the truth of Christianity. Many have endorsed the conclusion of 18th century statesman George Littleton that the conversion and apostleship of St. Paul alone, duly considered, was of itself a demonstration sufficient to prove Christianity to be a divine revelation."
Now, all of that is quite convincing to me as well.
The integrity of Paul's message.
But there's more about Paul's conversion that gives us another layer of evidence. If Christianity is all made up, then why, after Paul's conversion, does he write and preach for so many years the exact gospel message of Jesus' ministry, his teachings, his death, and resurrection? The story, especially the resurrection, says Bruce, is, quote, "an incredible assertion," end quote. During a time when many of the 500 witnesses that Jesus appeared to after his resurrection were still alive, and no doubt were counted among the recipients of his letters. If Paul had gotten any of Jesus' teachings or history wrong, there would have been dissension. And yet, in the historical record, we see no argument to the contrary, no counter to the story of Christ's resurrection, or anything like it. Of all that Paul preached about Christian doctrine, there would have been something he got wrong had he made any of it up. The only way this makes any sense at all is if what Paul asserts about Jesus is true. And again, remember, this is from a man who was previously imprisoning Christians and living the good life because of it, but now is frequently on the run and risking death at every turn. So that's evidence for Paul. He was not a companion of Christ, nor of the apostles. And yet he is a remarkable outside independent witness to the truth of Jesus Christ. Now, are there any questions about this material about Paul before I go on to the next section?
When and why does Saul get his name changed to Paul? And are we really sure they are the same person?
We do not have any explicit evidence of exactly when or why his name was changed. Some think it might have been at his baptism by Ananias, when converts take on Christian names. But we don't know. In Acts, Luke refers to Saul early on, and at one point in Acts 13, Luke writes,
"But Saul, also known as Paul,"
and after that, Luke is consistent to use the name Paul, unless he's quoting Paul, who is telling his conversion story. And then Luke accurately quotes Paul in saying that he, Paul that is, heard from Christ on the Damascus Road say, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" Also, in all his epistles, Paul refers to himself as Paul, not Saul. Now Luke is very thorough and accurate in his reporting. And that leads me to our next topic or piece of evidence regarding the authenticity of the New Testament, attested by outside witnesses.
Luke.
Now, class, as we've already noted, most of the information we have about Paul, at least from the book of Acts, was authored by Luke. Luke is known to have written not only the Gospel of Luke, but also the Gospel's historical continuation, which we find in the Acts of the Apostles. Luke was a physician by training and trade, and as far as we can tell, he was from Antioch in Syria. Now, what really makes him an outsider to the original core group of Christians is that he was a Gentile, and he is likely the only Gentile among New Testament writers. So he becomes an outsider of extreme importance. It wasn't until some time after the Christian church was formed, somewhat loosely, we must grant, that Gentiles were considered even eligible to become Christians. And who is it that tells of this momentous occasion? It is Luke, the Gentile.
Circumcision of Gentiles.
In Acts 10, 1 through 2, Luke recounts the incredible story of Cornelius, a Roman centurion living in Caesarea, who was known as a devout man who feared God with all his household and gave alms liberally to the poor. That in itself is interesting. Who would have thought that there was a Roman soldier leading an Italian detachment of peacekeeping soldiers in Palestine who was a believer? But then, perhaps, this was the same centurion that stood at the foot of the cross when Jesus died and said, "Surely this was the Son of God." We don't know that, but you have to admit it's interesting to speculate. So Luke tells us that because of this centurion's faith, the one in Caesarea, God sends an angel and tells Cornelius to send for and bring back to his home Peter. And the angel tells Cornelius where to find Peter. So a couple of servants and a devout soldier of Cornelius are sent to fetch Peter. Meanwhile, Peter's having a vision of all kinds of unclean animals, reptiles, and birds being dropped out of the sky in a blanket, and of which God is telling him to rise, kill, and eat. But Peter says, "No, they're unclean." And God says, "Who are you to tell me that they're unclean if I say otherwise?" The visions happen three times before Peter gets the message. Can't be too casual about these things, you know. Now Peter wakes up from his dream, trying to figure it out, when Cornelius' servants and soldier show up, and God tells Peter to go with these men immediately. So the next day, Peter, along with some acquaintances, leave Joppa and go with Cornelius' messengers to Caesarea. And when they arrive at Cornelius' house, where Cornelius has gathered a whole bunch of people, Cornelius asks Peter to preach. Can you imagine an open invitation like that? I can't. What we have here is the first meeting of the first church of Caesarea. Anyhow, Peter talks with them a bit and finds out that they are all believers, but they are all Gentile. And it's then that Peter puts together the dream and the messengers, that salvation is open to the Gentiles as well. Now, what's interesting here is that Peter doesn't bring all these people in Cornelius' house to faith. They were already believers. We know this because of what Luke tells us in Acts 10. In verse 36, when Peter first begins his talk, he says,
"You already know the word."
And then Peter recounts the short history of the promised Messiah and his death and resurrection. And Peter invokes the prophets of old that
everyone who believes in him receives forgiveness of sins through his name.
And bang, the Holy Spirit falls on all those that are gathered and they begin speaking in tongues and extolling God. And it's important that all this happens in front of the witnesses that Peter brought along from Joppa. Peter says,
"Can anyone forbid water for baptizing these people who have received the Holy Spirit just as we have?"
Evidently, no one objects. And so all those that Cornelius had gathered were baptized into the faith. Now, that's the story of how the first Gentiles were officially brought into the faith. And who tells it to us? The only Gentile writer of the New Testament. This is powerful outside evidence of the authenticity of the Christian story, especially when you realize that people that knew the people at the first church of Caesarea would later read Luke's account in Acts as it was passed around the churches. And again, there is no historical record of any dissent to what Luke writes. Therefore, it must be considered as valid, first-hand evidence. Class, allow me to be presumptuous, but this story should send shivers up your spine. What a revelation this is for the church, that salvation is not just for Jews, but to anyone who believes. But then, if we think back to the Old Testament, we realize that there were Egyptians that left Egypt with Moses and the Israelites, and these non-Jews were circumcised and became part of the great Jewish nation.
Circumcision of Gentiles.
Now, this issue of circumcision leads to the next event in this story that Luke is no doubt anxious to tell. For in Acts 15 at Jerusalem, we read about the first church council, the council at Jerusalem. Luke tells us that some men had come down from Judea to Antioch and were telling the Christians at Antioch that in order for Gentile males to be saved, they had to be circumcised, and there was no small debate over this. So the leaders at Antioch appealed to the head of the church, as they understood it, and sent Paul, Barnabas, and others to Jerusalem to consult with the apostles and the other church elders. The whole debate is related in Acts 15, including reference to a prophecy of Amos that was interpreted to predict the inclusion of Gentiles in God's order. In the end, the apostles, led by Peter, decide that it is an unnecessary burden on Gentiles to be circumcised. So they write a letter to Antioch to that effect, further advising the leaders in Antioch that Gentiles need only to refrain from eating food sacrificed to idols, and from blood, and from what is strangled, and from unchastity. So with this first church council, Gentiles are officially in without the necessity of circumcision and the burden it would bear. And it is Luke that tells us the story. Now, this is an important story because it affected thousands of Gentile believers who must have rejoiced at reading these accounts in Acts 10 and 15. And again, we have writings that were shared throughout the church and must have accurately reflected the events, because they were read by many who knew the events already, and by not objecting to the events, attested Luke's record as trustworthy.
Luke's political knowledge.
Okay, let's move on to the next point, the accuracy of Luke's political knowledge and how any glaring mistake on Luke's part of recording the history of the day would have been the smoking gun that what Luke was chronicling was not true. The Christian church owes a great debt to Dr. Luke and the high traditions of Greek historical writing that Luke brings to his New Testament work, for he is the thoroughly competent and accurate historian. In all the New Testament, Luke is the only one to mention the names of Roman emperors, Augustus, Tiberius, and Claudius. In addition, Bruce lists for us the names of various Jewish and Gentile leaders, the names of whom Luke invokes. We meet
Roman governors Quirinius, Pilate, Sergius, Pallas, Gallio, Felix, and Festus, Herod the Great and some of his descendants, Herod Antipas, the Tetrarch of Galilee, the vassal kings Herod Agrippa 1 and 2, Bernice and Drusilla, leading members of the Jewish priestly caste, such as Annas, Caiaphas, and Ananias, and Gamaliel, the greatest contemporary rabbi and Pharisaic leader.
Now, any historical writer who lists the contemporary names and titles of so many personages runs the risk of being called out for his mistakes. But Luke takes the risk, and based on the secular historical writings we have available today, passes with flying colors, even getting the various titles of these men correct. This makes Luke's writing accurate, and thus the stories he tells come off as trustworthy as well. Bruce spends considerable time recounting with great detail the cross-referencing of Luke's account with secular accounts of the same time, and reveals Luke to be the consummate historian worthy of high praise.
Luke's nautical knowledge.
Then there is the account of Paul's shipwreck on Malta, with Luke at his side as an eyewitness to the events, recorded in Acts 27. Luke begins by giving the name of the centurion, Julius, and the branch of his detachment, Augustan cohort, and then the name of the large merchant grain ship, Adramyttium, with 276 souls on board. The ship did not have oarsmen, like the Roman galleys, but only sails, a rudder, and anchors to control its passage. It was probably 200 to 300 feet long, 45 to 60 feet wide, and capable of carrying tons of stores and wheat. It was no doubt a merchant grain ship. Luke names a companion, Aristarchus, and then details of their route through the Mediterranean, under the lee of Cyprus, under the lee of Crete off Somone, under the lee of a small island named Cauda. Then Luke shares minute details of seamanship, like,
"They lowered the gear. We were so driven. We managed to secure the boat, the small shore boat on deck. They sounded and found 12 fathoms, 15 fathoms, hoisting the foresail to the wind."
And many other details of the trip and the shipwreck and how every soul was saved. Now there is much more detail in Acts 27 that is interesting to read. Now I'm not a sailor, nor is Bruce, but I have talked with sailors, and Bruce has done some research, and one, James Smith, made his Lucian account of Paul's journey by boat and the shipwreck somewhat his life's work. An archaeologist and biblical scholar of the 19th century was James Smith of Jordan Hill, who lived from 1782 to 1867. He was also an experienced yachtsman who was knowledgeable of the Mediterranean where Paul sailed. He wrote an extensive account of the ship's journey and wreck in a book that was first published in 1848. It is still considered the standard work on the subject. The book is titled The Voyage and Shipwreck of St. Paul. Smith was also fluent in Greek, and the book makes use of interlinear Greek-English biblical texts, nautical charts, illustrations, citations, bibliography, a geographical survey of Malta and the sea approaches and indexes. He claims that Luke's account is extremely accurate in terms of both seamanship and geography. Smith says that upon reconnoitering Malta, as he did, he was able to perfectly locate the beach where the Adramyttium went aground. Now, all of these details, from the first chapters of Luke's Gospel to the shipwreck of Paul on Malta, demonstrate that Luke, the physician, was a man of habitual accuracy. And further, let it not go unnoticed that James Smith also becomes an independent outside piece of evidence.
Luke's historical accuracy.
Next, we come to Sir William Mitchell Ramsay, who lived from 1851 to 1939. Ramsay was a Scottish archaeologist who devoted many years in Asia Minor uncovering lost cities and records. When he first set out on his archaeological work, he subscribed to the then fashionable Tubingen theory, which doubted the historical accuracy of the New Testament and which claimed that the book of Acts was not written by Luke, but was created 100 years later and cobbled together from legends, fancy, and whatnot. And so it was not what it claimed to be. When Ramsay set off on his work, he firmly intended to prove the book of Acts was hopelessly inaccurate, and he devoted his life to uncovering the archaeological facts as he could find them. Ramsay's final conclusion is this:
Luke's history is unsurpassed in respect of its trustworthiness, one of the most instructive documents for the knowledge of ancient seamanship. Luke is a historian of the first rank. Not merely are his statements of fact trustworthy, he is possessed of the true historic sense. He fixes his mind on the idea and plan that rules in the evolution of history and proportions the scale of his treatment to the importance of each incident. He seizes the important and critical events and shows their true nature at greater length. When he touches lightly or omits entirely much that was valueless for his purpose. In short, this author should be placed along with the very greatest historians.
Now, class, I hope you can see that what we're dealing with in both Luke's Gospel and the book of Acts, we have not only an outsider, Luke, who who is not Jewish but a Gentile, and someone who has been trained as a physician, and who gives habitually accurate accounting of Jesus' early life, his ministry, his crucifixion, his resurrection, and then the early life of the church, and who follows Paul in the latter part of his life and documents it. This kind of evidence authenticates not only Luke's writings, but also helps to support the recorded life of Paul in his writings. Oh, and again, we have the independent outside witness of Sir William Mitchell Ramsay. Now, Ramsay's archaeological work leads us neatly to the third and final section of today's lecture.
Archaeological evidence.
So the question before us still is whether or not the events written about in the New Testament have any basis in fact. What evidence can we bring to this argument from what we read in the New Testament books? Are the events based, in fact, on character, geography, and the political setting of the time, as we can find in evidence outside the New Testament writings? Now, as we turn to the archaeological evidence, there is, admittedly, much less to report about New Testament discoveries as opposed to Old Testament discoveries. But let's have a crack at it and see what we can turn up.
The Trophimus Riot.
In Acts 21:27, we read about a temple riot that the Jews stirred up, claiming that Paul had brought a Greek, one Trophimus the Ephesian, into the inner court of the temple, which was strictly against Jewish law, and for doing so, death was the penalty. Driven by a false rumor, the riot converged on Paul with murderous intent. Roman soldiers heard about this, came, broke up the riot, and took Paul into custody, more to protect him than anything else, and then have his accusers appear before a Roman magistrate in an orderly and legal manner. Now, so anxious were the Romans to bring order to the city and not disrupt Jewish customs, they had agreed to execute even Roman citizens who made this offense, that is, a Gentile entering the inner court of the temple. And that is what the Jews have now accused Paul of doing, not of himself, for they knew he was a Jew, but of bringing in Trophimus. Well, none of that was true, of course, but that is beside the point. For us today, the point related to this little story about the riot, as relates to archaeological evidence, is this. Is there any evidence that substantiates this Jewish tradition between the inner and outer court, and this rule that any Gentile doing so should die? Well, in 1872, Charles Simon Clermont Gamow, who lived from 1846 to 1923, a French Orientalist and archaeologist, found a Greek inscription chiseled into a stone block in Jerusalem that reads,
"No foreigner may enter within the barricade which surrounds the temple and enclosure. Anyone who is caught doing so will have himself to thank for his ensuing death."
And there it is. There is the basis of the riot. We have factual historical information, carved in stone no less, that substantiates Luke's story. Okay, what else do we have? As I say, there's not a whole lot, but every little bit helps.
The Pool of Bethesda.
In John 5:2, the Pool of Bethesda is described as being near the Sheep Gate and having five porticos or porches, or five covered rows of colonnades surrounding it. So, is there such a pool or spring of water in that area? Or is there evidence that there once was? The problem with archaeological digs in Jerusalem is that present buildings are so dense, having been built on top of the rubble of the city destroyed in 70 AD, it is nearly impossible to trace the walls of structures without tearing down private property. Nonetheless, we know the Sheep Gate was in the north wall, near the east corner of the old city, but no pool was found in the early part of the 19th century. And for a long time, liberal scholars who do not believe the Bible and claim that events in the Bible were invented as metaphors said there was no such thing as the Pool of Bethesda because its location could not be confirmed. Well, in 1888, excavations near St. Anne's Church by archaeologist Conrad Sheik, who lived from 1822 to 1901, revealed an ancient church that seemed to have something to do with healing, and next to the old church was a circular water tank. Sheik thought the tank was the Bethesda Pool, but in Sheik's discovery, there was no evidence of porticos or porches. The excavations near St. Anne's Church continued off and on, and much later excavations revealed two much larger pools at the site, one which obviously flowed into the other, with surrounding colonnades, and there were porticos on the four sides of the larger rectangle prescribed by the two side-by-side pools, with steps leading down to the water, with a fifth row of colonnades over the dam area that separated the two pools. And this was right where John said it was, near the Sheep Gate, in the northeast quarter of Old Jerusalem. There was actually an earlier confirmation of Bethesda Pool's existence from an outside source, but Schick must not have been aware. In 333 AD, a French Christian made a pilgrimage from Bordeaux, France, to the Holy Land. He kept a detailed itinerary of his travels, including all the places he changed horses or halted for the night, and the Roman miles between each. The manuscript is one of the oldest Christian documents we have. It's called the Itinerarium Bourdaganus, written by an anonymous pilgrim we call the Pilgrim of Bordeaux. Once in the Holy Land, our pilgrim makes travel notes, and included in those notes is this entry.
There are in Jerusalem twin pools with five porticos, which are called Bethesda. There, persons who have been sick for many years are cured. The pools contain water, which is red when it is disturbed. There is also here a crypt in which Solomon used to torture devils.
So the liberals, wanting to prove the New Testament was fake, were proven wrong again, at least as far as this archaeological discovery takes us.
Paul as Hermes and Barnabas as Zeus.
And there are little details, class, that are seemingly insignificant until much later. In Acts 14:12, Luke mentions that when Paul and Barnabas showed up in Lystra of Asia Minor and healed a lame man, the locals were so excited they called Paul Hermes and Barnabas they called Zeus, and were convinced that the gods had visited them. So the people brought oxen and garlands to the gates and wanted to offer sacrifices on behalf of Paul and Barnabas. Paul and Barnabas thought their appreciation and generosity was a bit overboard, and they tore their garments and chastised them for the overt but kind display. Now, there are two details in this account that are noteworthy. One is the generosity of the locals, and the second is the attraction this group of people has for Hermes and Zeus. Not too many years later, the Roman poet Ovid, born in 53 BC, tells of the reception he received when he arrived in the same area of Lystra incognito, and was the recipient of this same overt hospitality from an aged couple who, although they didn't know Ovid, treated him much like the honor with which Paul and Barnabas were bestowed. And another indication of this particular area of Lystra was found in 1910 by Sir William Calder, who, upon doing some archaeological excavations in the area, found an inscription from about 250 AD that had something to do with the dedication of a statue of Hermes to Zeus. And then in 1926, Calder found an altar dedicated also to Zeus and Hermes. So this confirmed what Luke is writing in Acts, that Lystra was a hotbed for worship of Zeus and Hermes. And together, Ovid's observations and Calder's discoveries seem to confirm that what Luke writes has some credibility from archaeological evidence.
Discovery of New Testament fragments.
And finally, there is the discovery of over 5,000 fragments of secular, canonical, and non-canonical Christian writings from the 2nd to 4th century in a place called Oxyrhynchus, Egypt. These are the Oxyrhynchus papyri, which were found in an ancient Egyptian rubbish dump in the late 19th and early 20th century by papyrologists Bernard Grenfell and Arthur Hunt. Among these are both the Old and New Testament fragments, as well as fragments of many non-canonical writings, such as a collection of statements, each beginning with the phrase, "Jesus said." There are also fragments of writings by the early church fathers, such as Irenaeus, as well as the Nicene Creed, and many Christian prayers and hymns. Now, while some of these fragments do establish the spread of Christianity into Egypt, some do nothing to help us understand the New Testament. But the non-canonical, even Gnostic documents, like the Gospel of Thomas, which were found among the Oxyrhynchus papyri, do give us evidence to several notions about Christianity. One is that in the 2nd through the 4th century, there were groups of people all over the Middle East and into Africa that not only knew of Jesus, but followed his teachings, albeit oftentimes in unorthodox ways. So the claim that Jesus was some sort of recently contrived myth is, in fact, a myth itself. Now, there is much more detail that you'll find in Bruce's 8th chapter, which I hope you read before the exam on this material. Now, the bell is about to ring, so hold your questions until our next session. That's all for this morning.
Thank you for listening to the Basic Christianity Podcast, a college lecture series by Dr. Stanley D. Walters, presented by his student, Dr. Stanley D. Williams. The 33 lectures are found in Dr. Walters' fully illustrated book, Basic Christianity, Facts, Evidences, Reasons, available at ninevascrossing.com. Thank you for listening.